Robin McCarron.
Breaking news, the rating for Raw is likely to fall at 2.7 or 2.8. Sting versus Flair did a 5.4.
Jeff Hawkins.
This is a joke. I'm going to kick your butt once I get bail. I'm gonna come after you.
You're listening to Shake Them Ropes with Rob McCarron and Jeff Hawkins.
There ain't no stopping us now. We celebrate on the floor. Top down, we're ready to go. To all the people across every nation, turn it up and give me some more. Balloon Guy!
It's been a long, long time. You're such a sight. You're looking better than a body has a right to. Don't you know we're playing with fire, but we can't stop this burning desire. Leah. Referred to by Corey Graves this week on Raw. The great Pittsburgh legend. Donnie Iris. Aliyah. On Raw, it's time to start trading wins going into the four-way, and Bayley's involvement is in doubt. SmackDown, Nakamura beats Cena, and Swole Shane and KO, as seeds for a match later, are being planted. Bring It to the Table takes it to Alexa Bliss, and Aleister Black is a Red Dragon Slayer. All that and Alex Riley in a dressed-up, dumpy American Legion Hall make their debut on this week's Glow. Joining me this week, special guest from the Voices of Wrestling neighborhood, Lucha of the Hidden Temple host, Chris Novembrino. So, Chris, I noticed on your show, you're after Battleground, you're kind of moving into our neighborhood, taking our turf. What do you got to say for yourself? Defend yourself, Mr. Lucha Underground.
I went to the show. I was physically at the show. I'm allowed to talk about wrestling shows that I actually go to, right?
Yes. Oh, heck. We've gone to LU territory. I'm just busting your balls a little bit here. You know, you're part of the family. You're Italian. We're part of this big Voices of Wrestling mafia family that we got here with Lanza as our Don and Rich as the conciliary and everything. So, yeah.
Don Lanza made me a made man.
No, it was just funny because I downloaded it and went, oh, Chris talks about Battleground. I'm like, wait a second, Mr. Lucha Underground. Get out of our, stay in your lane, fool. We own WWE in this part. No, I like that. And I told you I was going to mention him. Donnie Iris. Did you have any idea what that name drop was when he made it?
No, that one went way over my head. Sometimes Graves has deep cuts, and I don't quite follow.
This would be a deep cut because unless you're from Pittsburgh or you were very big on like 80s one-hit wonders or even late or early 70s one-hit wonders, you would not know who Donnie Iris was. Donnie Iris is kind of a nerd in rock and roll. He's kind of the bridge between Buddy Holly and, say, Rivers Cuomo in terms of his look.
Okay.
But he had this minor hit called Aliyah in like 1982. It's a real kind of, you know, you're driving top-down Pontiac Fiero type of guitar hit that got him a lot of minor celebrity. And then he became kind of that, every region has that kind of musical legend who has that minor hit. And then from then on, they're invited to every single like city picnic and whatever, and the music of Donnie Iris and the Cruisers. You know, that's him in Pittsburgh. But before that, he had a number one hit in 1972 with a group called the Jaggers called The Rapper. I don't know if you've ever, it's played in a lot of like Vietnam era type soundtrack movies and things of that nature. So finding that out, he was an earworm because I was driving down the road about 2 weeks ago and Aliyah came on. And I'm like, I've heard this song before and I like it. Who does this? Who? And so I went down that kind of Wikipedia rabbit hole of reading about the guy, and he's a fascinating dude.
Yeah. He was also in Wild Cherry, I'm seeing.
Yeah, but that was after Play That Funky Music. That was like when Wild Cherry was trying to maintain relevance, I think, after their number one hit. I thought he was a part of that because he has kind of that white boy soul type thing going as well. But no, he's an interesting cat. I it's rare that I mark for a reference by Corey Graves. I'm like, oh, that's my recent earworm, Donnie Iris. Let's start with, I guess, the top story is we're now building to this four-way to Raw between Brock, Braun Strowman, Roman Reigns, and Samoa Joe, and they beat Joe clean. What were your thoughts just concerning the entire build this week on that?
beating Joe clean, I've become desensitized to it because I have had to come to terms with this notion that Samoa Joe is never going to get treated on the Raw brand the way I want him to get treated.
Okay. Oh,
where do you want me to go now? What do I think about the actual main event angle? I think there's too many cooks in the kitchen.
Okay. I just, you know, for me, I think this is kind of that point. WWE and their booking, when they have a multi-person match, it becomes trading wins. But I don't think Roman or Braun especially are going to get pinned clean necessarily going into this match. I think it's going to be like count out or disqualification, and Joe's going to be the only one who gets pinned. And I think that that kind of leads to tipping the hand of the finish of this of the match at SummerSlam in some ways. Although I'm not sure yet. I haven't really decided who's winning this match yet, because I think...
What's your thinking right now?
My thinking right now is in the last half of the year is always the time they put the title on someone not traditional, but a guy that they just want to see how far he can go with it. Now, if I were running a professional wrestling company, that would be Joe, because Joe can talk, and Joe has badass credibility. But I can't see them, if they don't keep the belt on Brock, I can't see them getting around the temptation to put it on Braun Strowman and see what they have here. Because he's big, he's spectacle, he's homegrown versus a guy like Joe. He's young, he gets great crowd reactions, and look, for the amount of time he's been in the business, he's good. I don't view him as a work rate machine in any ways. But the WWE style doesn't need work rate necessarily. They need guys who can do three or four moves pretty good and tell a story. So I could just see Vince going, well, let's see what the kid has. We'll put a rocket to him. And then taking the belt off of him, say, before Royal Rumble, so that they can build to whatever they want at Mania. But, I mean, I
think you've got to kick the tires on Braun Strowman. I'm with you. I think it's time to see how far you can take it. They have groomed a really nice comic bookish sort of cartoonish monster guy with Braun Strowman that is connecting really well with the audience. I love his tagline of "I'm not finished with you." Like every time he says that, I mark.
Yeah, I didn't like his promo into the camera this week.
No,
because it was a bit of a ripoff of Nia Jax's thing, because he starts with "I'm not like most men." You know, it's like okay, it just came off as there's comic book evil and there's real menacing evil, and it came off as kind of the first one where it's like, you know, the bad guy appears and he says, "Ha ha, I'm here to fight you, Captain America," you know, or whatever, and you just kind of go, no, that's not what I want to see out of this guy. I want to be scared of him when I come to an arena. And I don't know if they can get out of their way with those types of impulses, which is also why I don't think Joe's going to be the guy to top line. Although, you know, it's also one of those things where the guy they beat clean, if they do it the build that I'm thinking the way they're going to do it, that's usually the guy that wins it. So I can
see
Joe pulling one out here, and just them having, you know, hey, he's a guy who can use his mouth to get another program over. And then if we wanted to in the fall, we could have Braun beat him and put the belt on him for a short time before going into our build the next year's WrestleMania.
I think that's the safer move. I think with Samoa Joe, you can put the belt on him. You can trust that he can handle program to program. You know what the floor is going to be with Samoa Joe, and the floor is going to be far above acceptable. Whereas I think if you put the belt on Roman right now, you don't know what you're going to get from week to week with the fan reaction. I think that would be probably a mistake. With Strowman, I don't trust them to book him the way he would need to be booked. Because in my head, if Strowman's the champion, I want him to just constantly be showing up throughout Raw and just beating up people. Like, now that he's champion, like, he believes that this show is entirely his dominion and he has the ability to smash everything.
Yeah, I'm thinking that too. But yeah, they don't do well with these Agents of Chaos type of stories. Because, I mean, I thought that's what the Wyatt family was going to be.
You know, it requires too much discipline.
Well, it requires violence. It requires violence and unknown things and things that may make advertisers a bit skittish if you're considering this a quote-unquote children's product in some ways. I mean, like for me, the last great moment like that was the Nexus invasion. And you saw what happened there. I mean, Daniel Bryan got fired for choking a guy with a tie because I guess the people from Mattel didn't like it all that much. And really, after that, everything about the Nexus kind of turned into a normal WWE faction-type feud where, like, one guy is the star and everybody else is kind of cannon fodder. But I will give them credit. They are doing a better job with Braun than they ever did with Big Show. And Big Show was a much bigger deal at the time of jumping during the Attitude Era.
I completely agree. I think that they've actually done a pretty good job with Braun Strowman across the board, which is an interesting contrast to the handling of Roman Reigns, where it feels like they've had to really struggle to get that guy where he is. Whereas with Braun Strowman, everything's fallen into place rather naturally.
Yeah. Moving on to other things in Raw, Bayley getting injured 3 weeks outside. It appears that she may have a shoulder injury of some kind. They're going to give her some time to try and rehab it. But this is fascinating to me because it's almost the reverse of what happened to Sasha Banks when they ended up bringing Bayley up far too quick. And Sasha came back. It was like they brought Bayley up, put the title on her, and kind of then decided, well, now we need Sasha back in the picture, and we're kind of. But this time, it seems like they're getting it a bit right. Do you think that they're making a mistake? And maybe we can go in a little bit to bring it to the table talk here. Are they making a mistake by really pushing kind of a possibility of? I mean, or at least just making a lot of the Sasha Alexa feud rather than concentrating on the Bayley Alexa feud.
The Sasha Alexa feud in the bring it to the table context is really weird. I'm guessing it's rooted on some level of realness, but
yeah.
There's also a way that they work on bring it to the table where it's like some of the stuff is directly addressing real concerns that the internet fan has. And the other stuff on bring it to the table is more like planting seeds that sort of feel real but aren't real, a la Vince Russo.
Yeah, it's the Baghdad Bob of the WWE. It's telling you what they want you to talk about and what they want your opinion to be, but I'll be a little bit more specific. Actually, I'll address your thing. There is the rumor, or at least talk, that Sasha and Alexa did not get along in NXT, and that Alexa felt that Sasha was a bit sloppy in a few matches with her, ended up punching her in the nose a couple times, once breaking it at least. So, and there's rumor that there's some legitimate animosity there. The thing that I took out of the Alexa Bliss part was the number of times they said she wasn't a good wrestler. And I'm like, WWE never does that with people.
That is interesting.
They never say, you know, she's not the best wrestler in the world, but she's a personality. She's not the best wrestler in the world, but she's a personality. I'm like, this is a company that will tell you that a guy with 1.5 moves is the next big thing in the WWE. And for them to say that publicly, or at least bring it up as kind of a weird theoretical talking point, absolutely floored me. But
especially in the context of Alexa, because
yeah.
The whole idea with Alexa is that she's supposed to be very athletic. And I will say this in defense of Alexa, I think her promos have come a long way.
I think
she was
fine.
Really rough at one point, and she's gotten a lot better.
Yeah, no, I think in the ring she's fine, and her promo work, you're right. Her facials, her acting is absolutely great. But I think what it was it's a misstep on their part. They're trying to play up the whole... They're trying to play up Sasha as the big, great wrestler from NXT who's known for great matches versus the quote-unquote, well, Alexa's just a personality who's here, and they're trying to play up. It's kind of in that same way that the Miz-Daniel Bryan feud was kind of built, where Alexa's the soft style version while Sasha really loves this business type of thing. I mean, does that make any sense to you?
It does. I think that there is one disparity there in the difference between Daniel Bryan and The Miz, and I know this is going to get me in trouble, but Sasha's kind of sloppy. like, she has her moments where she is not necessarily on point. I think that both Alexa and Sasha are prone to flubs.
Yeah. She gets excited. The momentum is there, and sometimes she just wants to do too much. I think it's a valid argument.
There's another line in that segment in Bring It to the Table that I wanted to mention, which is the, is Sasha her own worst enemy? But that framing of is blank their own worst enemy comes up a lot on Bring It to the Table. But in the context of Sasha, how did you read that?
I read it as, especially the Raw segment, maybe she spoke a little bit out of school in terms of what she was saying there in terms about Alexa not knowing the Hardy brothers apart and not being a real fan. And that's another reason why you put the kibosh on talking smack, I think. I think occasionally you get that comment that's a little too real in there. And even though it's interesting to us, it kind of, the casual fan will be like, well, what are they talking about? And maybe it kind of breaks the fourth wall a little bit. I also think, look, and this will bring us back to Bayley, and it, one of my fears is that with Sasha and Bayley wanting to do so much and have these great legendary matches, that their style is being seen as injury prone, as opposed to just wear and tear of, say, a schedule on, for like, I mean, on the physicality taking its toll on women. And them being kind of quote-unquote weaker, but also exacerbating it with their style.
Yeah, I think there's something to that. I think there's something to the notion that both Bayley and Sasha are people with thinner frames and less muscle to protect the bones. So when a person like Bayley takes a bump, there's not a lot of padding there.
Right, and there's also, I think there's also a bit of a disconnect between Vince and that crew of women, where those women are wrestling fans, and they're trying to cater to wrestling fans rather than work a softer style, get your moments, do your little movements, get over with the crowd, and go home, and do it every night, 5 nights a week on the road, as opposed to doing all these dangerous spots which are going to put you at risk.
Yeah, there's definitely that component too. But you see someone like Charlotte, and her body is able to hold up a little bit better because I think she's a bit bigger.
Yeah, she has a much bigger frame, and so yeah, she can do, you know, the moonsaults and moves like that night after night after night and not have that kind of noticeable wear and tear. I think you're exactly right on that, and I think that's also why, you know, Vince tends to gravitate towards people with bigger frames in terms of the women, if they're going to be quote unquote wrestlers. I mean, I'll ask you this then: do you think Bayley makes it to SummerSlam, or do they make a change, or do they add a third, or what do they do here?
Well, it depends on the seriousness of the shoulder injury, but you know, I've had shoulder injuries, and I will say that she should probably rehab it, and coming back too soon runs the risk of injuring it further. And even watching that match with Nia, it looked like the match went on for several more moves after the actual shoulder injury occurred. I thought that she did a bit of unnecessary damage to try to get through this match to get to a countout finish.
Yeah, I think she'll power through to get to SummerSlam. But I don't think she's winning the title at SummerSlam. I think if there was any talk
That's risky.
Yeah, if there was any talk of her winning the title, taking off Alexa to eventually get it to Nia Jax in some way, I think that's done. And the other last thing for Raw, for me at least, I'm going to skip one of the things I gave you on the rundown. The Hardys are now, he's now woken Matt Hardy.
Yes. That was fun.
I bring this up because Rob, the usual guy here, says that this is never going to happen. There's never going to be any kind of broken Matt Hardy universe.
Oh, this
in
is
the
Rob who said that CM Punk was never going to fight in the UFC, right? He was going to eat a hat or something?
Yes, he's still... Oh, God, he's going to kill me because now he's going to get tweets about eating that hat again. Yes, that is exactly what he said.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's happening, although if you watch the After Talk segment of Raw, it's like Matt Hardy slides in and out of the broken character. I watched it twice because he starts as regular Matt, Then he goes to Broken Woken Matt, and then he slides back out to regular Matt again.
You know, with all the sub all the sub groups in wrestling criticism these days, there's a part of me, and you'll appreciate this, doing a political podcast as well. There's part of me that wants this gimmick to be woke Matt Hardy.
Yeah, you know,
where he's complaining about,
yes,
where he's complaining, yes, about intersectionality, and just, you know, these women aren't getting enough time on Raw this week.
I want him to present charts of breakdowns of who's getting time on Raw, that sort of thing, and talk about all of these sorts of things. Yes, I'm with you. I get why they went with Woken, because it rhymes with broken, but the second I heard woke, I was like, oh, Matt Hardy as woke in that context would be hilarious.
Yeah, I still think they're going to stay fairly far away from the intellectual property while it's still in court. And it's just going to be kind of a new type of thing with remnants of the character you recognize. I just don't see them wanting to run afoul and find themselves in court. My theory was, if it doesn't cost WWE one dime, and if the Hardys can't take it with them when they leave, sure, they'll use it. But other than that, if they can't see a reason to make money, they're going to stay away from this if it costs them anything.
So I don't think they're going to be the broken characters. What I think we're seeing is that broken / woken is going to be a mode that they occasionally slide into and out of.
Oh, okay. That sounds interesting. I'll give you the option. Do you have anything about this whole Cass Enzo Big Show thing that ended Raw?
Oh, other than I really don't like this angle. They finally made Big Cass's music less terrible, but it still doesn't really fit him.
I thought what they did with Seth Rollins' music was god awful.
Yeah.
Burn it to the ground or burn it down or whatever. I'm just like, no, it's fine without words. They did the same thing with the Usos' music this week. They added words where they didn't need it. I remember they used to do this in the Attitude Era with, who's it, Benoit's theme. They did it.
Oh, God, with Stabbing Westward. Right. They took a perfectly good theme and put Stabbing Westward over the top of it.
Yeah, and they did it with Kane's theme also.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, what a terrible move on their part. But I do, just as an aside, I'm liking the slow build of this whole Dean Seth thing, and it can go a number of different ways. I just hope they don't get too obvious about it. I'm really liking that. But in terms of Cass and Enzo and stuff like that, how is Enzo Amore in any way a babyface in all this?
He's manipulating the Big Show to fight his fight for him because he can't win the fight against Big Cass, and he keeps wanting to fight Big Cass. And you are absolutely right. After the first time he loses to Big Cass, it's like the character doesn't really have a point of grievance anymore, unless he's going to train really hard and do a sort of Rocky, I'm going to, you know, train up and get ready to fight Big Cass, and this is going to be my WrestleMania moment. But that doesn't feel like where this is going at all.
Yeah, earlier this week I tweeted a picture from the Warner Brothers cartoons of the dog, Foghorn Leghorn, and the Chicken Hawk. That's exactly what this whole thing is, and Enzo's the Chicken Hawk. And he's not gonna give up, but it's just like Big Show's like Foghorn Leghorn. Now boy, I say, you know, stop getting me in trouble all the time. And there's the dog waiting to beat him up. This was brought up on the board. Is Cass, in terms of moveset, is he just Test 2.0?
I think in so many ways he's Test 2.0. Even his theme update is really kind of reminiscent of Test. Yeah, a little bit.
Okay, because I think he has more personality than Test. I do.
I will definitely concede that. He cuts a better promo, although this character still doesn't really have direction. He just repeatedly says, I'm where the money's at.
I'm tall, so I should be a star. Yes. And for me, from an acting point of view, he either has his words and then finds the emotion halfway through a promo, or he has the emotion and can't remember the words halfway through the promo. He needs to sync those two things up real quick, because it's like, but what they're scripting him isn't helping him at all either.
Yeah, this was a move with the Cass character that I think still needs a little bit more of a concept of, like, how does Big Cass see himself now? I get the idea that Enzo was dead weight holding him back, but what's the bigger vision? I don't think they've really thought about that yet.
Yeah, that's so weird, because it's like, well, we know we want him to be something, so we're going to treat him like something. but we don't have a path just yet. I mean, long-term scripting has never been a big thing for these kinds of. I mean, look what they did with Corbin when they brought him up to the main roster, and it was just like, okay, we're going to have him feud with Dolph and Zack Ryder over and over and over again. And that's kind of what they've been doing ever since. They've been moving him up incrementally, up trading wins of sorts, but not a real quote-unquote storyline plan and not a real motivation other than I'm here.
They figured some of that. Oh, sorry. They figured some of that out on Talking Smack.
Yes.
Where they let Corbin get on the mic and he would just talk about, look, I come from professional sports. I'm a winner. That's what I do. I should be on the top because I am a winner.
Yeah. And they never let him say that on TV. They always have JBL kind of say that for him,
yeah,
on the commentary, which I don't think. For a guy like that, he needs to do his own talking. We need to hear from,
yes,
him. We don't need to hear someone, you know, it's like someone says you're the best. No, I want to see you be the best. That's what I, you know, show me, don't tell me type of thing, which WWE tends to make as a crutch. So moving chronologically, anything else from Bring It to the Table you wanted to bring
up?
Oh,
actually, I wanted to talk about one more thing from Raw real quick.
Okay, sure.
Jason Jordan on Raw, and also Kurt Angle as GM. So I have been catching up on Raw and watching this Kurt Angle as GM experiment. And look, I'm a huge Kurt Angle fan. He's actively bad on Raw a lot.
I think so too. Yeah.
Yes, he's actively bad.
I mean, it's like that. It's so playing to the back of the room in every line he says. And to me, it's very stiff and it's very put upon. I mean, it's really, I don't think it's doing him any favors. And I think also he's obviously not in the same shape he was, but he's a lot bigger. So it looks like he's getting more flush easy. So it looks like he's almost like having a heart attack out there at times, or he just starts breaking into a sweat like 20 seconds into his promo. And I'm just like, I don't think he's coming off well in any of these segments at all.
He's not natural. He is loaded up with too many lines, and he is trying his damnedest to stick to them. I actually think they should send him out with a card, and so that he doesn't just have to freewheel off the top of his head, because it really hurts his delivery. It would be better if he just has a list of the matches on a card. I think that's perfectly acceptable. Here's your card for tonight. He holds it up to the audience and then reads off from the card.
Yeah, the magic of the pre-tapes that he used to be in during the Attitude Era was he was the foil. He was the comedic foil who had the laugh line all the time. And in sitcom writing, you have that one character where every line he says is supposed to be a laugh line. And that was Kurt's job, you know, with Edge and Christian, or when he was, you know, wearing the stupid dinky cowboy hat and with Sheriff Austin. He was the comedic foil who every line he had was a short quip that would get a laugh. Now he's kind of the straight man doing all the exposition. And he's trying to keep all the verbiage straight, and you can tell he's getting jumbled up in it because he'll backtrack,
yep,
and start going all over again. And I wouldn't disagree with you having a cue card out there for him.
No, he could really benefit from that. And to get into Jason Jordan and the Miz angle, I think that it was a smart move to try to reset Jordan and pair him with the guy who is the most certifiable heel in the company, in the, mm-hmm, Miz. The Miz is completely unlikable, and the Jordan experiment was already starting to go off the rails where people were booing him. And I feel bad for this guy because I like him as a wrestler. I just think that he is slotted a terrible character. And I actually like the intersection of Jordan and the Miztourage, and the fact that the Miz was trying to get Jordan to join the Miztourage, because the whole idea of the Miztourage is that they are sons of established wrestlers. So now there's actually a link and almost a rationale for The Miz to try to rope Jordan into that.
Yeah, I think Jordan's just out of his element playing this kind of wholesome character.
Oh, yeah.
that eventually has to change emotion on a dime. That's never been his strong suit. His strong suit has kind of been, you know, the ultra
babyface
jock.
Fire.
Ultra jock,
yeah.
Babyface fire, and if he ever had to play heel, gym class bully. That was always his. And really, it was Gable that kind of brought the personality out of him. I think, you know, it's weird because you listen to criticism of Jordan in these segments, and everybody's consistently asking, is he supposed to be a heel? Is he supposed to be lying here? I don't think so. I think they're supposed to be straight ahead, and he's just not a good enough actor to pull it off right now.
I think that gets us into Bring It to the Table, too, Graves... Graves talks about that.
Sure. This will fit in, because I think Miz, just from an acting standpoint, is steamrolling the kid. And you can tell he puts in a few quips in there to try and needle some emotion out of Jason Jordan every so often. And Jordan's just kind of sitting there trying to remember his lines and kind of smirks at that, these little I wouldn't say shooty comments, but a little inside baseball to try and tweak him a bit. And it's not, it's...
Bringing up that the crowd is booing you is not
exactly
a very WWE move. They traditionally, they'll appeal to the WWE universe, but it's rare that you actually get the word boo or booing said by a wrestler.
I will stand up for Miz on this point, because I think by bringing that up, I think he was trying to elicit some sort of emotion out of the usually stoic Jordan rather than try and make Jordan feel bad.
I don't think that was sabotage. I think that was actually the Miz and the writers trying to do this lift of, okay, this Jordan angle is running the risk of moving to a place in terms of crowd dynamic, especially once we put Kurt and Jordan on the screen together, that we don't want. I mean, the last thing you want is for Kurt and Jordan to come out and for the crowd to be booing these guys. The optics of that are terrible.
Yeah, right now he's Eric Watts in WCW circa 1992, when Bill was the was running things, and it's like, here's my son, very talented, you know, and just the crowd just, and it wasn't that Eric Watts was bad, it was just everybody kind of viewed it as nepotism and undeserved, and here I think people aren't viewing it that way because it's obviously not real nepotism, but they're viewing it as a contrived push rather than push based on an earned ability or an earned way to getting people over. I mean, they see that it's a hook to use a music, you know, to use music parlance. It's a rap single with a great hook but terrible lyrics right now.
Yeah, it's a slant. It's like or like an M9 Shyamalan style twist.
Yeah.
Where we've got this twist. Wouldn't it be great if instead of Chad Gable, it's actually Jason Jordan who's Kurt Angle's kid? Okay. Then what?
Yeah, no, that's actually a better one. I like that a lot better. What were you gonna bring up for Bring It to the Table before I so rudely interrupted you?
No problem at all. Graves brings up Jason Jordan, and Graves gives him the vote of confidence. And with Bring It to the Table, I think it's – did you ever read, Greek philosophy, like Platonic dialogues or anything like that?
Yeah.
Okay, so I look at Bring It to the Table kind of the same way you'd look at, Plato's Symposium, where Peter, Corey, and JBL are playing, characters and avatars for bigger concepts.
Okay.
I'm still not clear entirely what Corey's role is in these dialogues. JBL is obviously the Vince surrogate, and Peter is obviously there to be the proxy for, us, the fan, and also us, the podcaster, as
Peter Rosenberg is there to be the voice of the casual fan. I think Corey is the voice of the smarky fan. The fan who knows just enough to be dangerous, but the one that Vince still wants to keep at an arm's length.
That's interesting. I think he's also there to kind of cudgel that fan, too.
Yes. Yeah. No, he's there to offset a little bit of JBL's Stephen A. Smith, Skip Bayless, so to speak. But he's there to endear himself to us, but also to give off the notion that he's being quote unquote fair minded. Also, I think, and he's playing all three of those roles at once, in my opinion.
I think that that's a really good read on him. He's the most complicated character of the three. But when they talked about Jordan, JBL just kept selling the genetics, which I think undermines the premise of Bring It to the Table. But the one thing that they both said is that they view his ceiling as unlimited, and they view Jason Jordan as a future champion, and anything less would be a bust.
That's,
that's quite a burden.
Well, that's the voice of Vince right there. I mean, that's some Drew McIntyre type of ceiling there, because I mean, if you do this too soon, I mean, he has to. They learn their mistakes occasionally, and if he doesn't,
he's the chosen son.
Yeah, if he doesn't have a great program here with Miz, there could be trouble, because they're not putting back. I mean, Chad Gable ain't walking through that door on Raw. I'll put it.
No,
that way.
And that wouldn't
think.
Work. You can't just glue it back together and have it have the same hold anymore.
Right.
So I think that's a problem too. And Graves likes Jason Jordan a lot personally, and that clearly comes off in these comments. But he does concede that Jordan needs a charisma injection quick, and also sort of hints at that's not really in Jordan's DNA. He's the likable, nice guy who works hard and has a great smile, and you like having him around, but he's not the life of the party or anything like that. That's not who he is.
Yeah, and that's a problem, because that's what they want him to be. They want him to be the life of the party. They want him to be the all-American boy who's, they want him to be Bob Backlund on meth, pretty much. I mean, they want him to be that happy, high-energy, rollicking good guy that everybody can get behind. And what he's coming off as a guy who's disingenuously trying, you know what it is? It's actually Kurt Angle's first run. That's what he's coming off as. He's coming off as the guy. You remember, because it was like, integrity and honesty and, the all-American hero that's really disingenuous about it. I mean, that's in a fit of irony. That if that he was playing that character, I think it would serve him a lot better.
Especially, I think
from a character standpoint and from just his natural abilities in terms of delivering promos, being kind of a disingenuous babyface.
This works a lot better, in my opinion, if Jordan's a heel. But the way they're booking him now, I think even getting him to being a heel, it's a little late. I think if they had gotten off the blocks, and the whole angle here is that Jason Jordan is manipulating Kurt Angle, who has a lot of heart but not a lot of brains, that would be interesting.
Yeah. And, well, I mean, that's a good segue. We can segue to Jordan's former partner, Chad Gable. I loved this Rusev match. This was like late 80s, early 90s, Steiner Brothers, Varsity Club. You know, I kind of put to it, Chad Gable's kind of getting the Tim Horner push here, where he's good enough to get a lot of offense on a guy, but he hasn't earned the big win yet. And when he earns the big win, theoretically, the crowd's gonna pop huge. The overhead belly to belly suplex spots where
they're taking really great care of him. They make him look like $1 million. He is getting to work with a whole bunch of guys and getting a lot of offense in. And yeah, I really enjoy these matches. And I think what they're doing with Gable is ultimately going to pay off, because I think it just keeps building the crowd's attachment to this hardworking, undersized, scrappy guy.
Yeah. And the thing that worked against him, though, was how they structured the show, because there's no way Rusev should have been cutting that promo and Randy Orton coming out right after that match.
Yeah.
There should have been a commercial break. There should have been a lot of, there's Gable, he gave it his all, give him the heroic send-off, show him kind of being helped to the back, how he gave it his all and everything, and really just kind of let that last camera shot linger on him. Go to commercial, and then when you come back, Rusev can cut that promo about having no challenge on SmackDown. Because all the goodwill you had from that match, from a sports entertainment point of view, absolutely dead with the Rusev-Orton thing coming in right after it.
I completely agree. I think that at the end of each one of these losses, and they've done this in other matches, so it's not new, Gable needs to look like he's dying a little inside. And we need to have a camera shot that focuses on Gable's anguished face as he stares back at the victor in the ring, because each one of these losses is eating him up inside.
I not only want that, because I love that idea. I absolutely love that idea. I want them to heighten that idea. I want, like, a segment later, have Renee outside of the locker room and giving that NCAA Final Four loser interview to him, where it's like, hey, you know, really tough scene here in the locker room. What happened out there tonight? And just have Gable kind of give that man, this absolutely crushed me tonight that I couldn't win in front of these fans right here. I want that kind of promo.
And I want those to build over the weeks. So each one, the first one is something like, look, you know, you win some, you lose some. I'm going to focus. I'm going to come back harder next week. And then 4 weeks from now, we're building to Chad Gable's at the breaking point during each one of these promos where he's eating himself upside. He's questioning himself. I think that that's the direction they need to go. I really like what they're doing with Gable, and I want them to do more.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. Let's see. They start off the show, AJ Styles and Kevin Owens. What a shock. Two great wrestlers having a great match. It's weird because it doesn't get boring.
Nope.
But it feels, I mean, it feels like they've been going back and forth for a while now, and the stakes haven't really been heightened. That's the weird thing to me about this feud. I don't want to say I'm bored by it, but I'm kind of waiting for the intensity to ramp up, and it seems like all that intensity now is possibly going to go to a start of a program to build to a WrestleMania match between Shane McMahon and Kevin Owens.
Ooh, see, I actually thought that there was a little bit of a Daniel Bryan tease, and I know that that's forbidden talk here, but the way that the special referee angle was set up, Bryan took a pregnant pause and stared at Kevin Owens and then said Shane.
Yeah, look, I don't think Daniel Bryan's ever coming back to a ring. I don't.
Yeah,
WWE. And God knows, looking at Shane on Tuesday night, Swole Patrol, right?
Oh, yeah, and, he's huge.
And he's gotten bigger since coming back. I mean, we laughed because when he first came back for WrestleMania, it's like he wasn't in shape. He was getting winded. And then all of a sudden, like within 2 weeks, he's in masterful shape. I'm not going to put any dispersions on anything on what
well, they don't test Shane on part-time performers,
right,
Jeff?
Right. No, I know. And he's been surfing a lot lately, so that he's been getting in shape. But I mean, he is more jacked than either competitor in this match. I think it has to be the natural thing because that's the move with Shane is they view Shane as a superstar. So you put him in there with a guy who and you hate to say this because they did the same thing kind of with AJ. It's like, well, you know, we're going to take a real chance on this guy. I mean, it's that whole, if you remember the story of CM Punk mentioned, you know what, we're going to do something different with you. And I just want to know if you can handle it. Can you handle playing heel? And CM Punk's like, what, are you kidding me? Yeah, it's that kind of thinking, I think, here with the, wow, we're going to take a real chance on this Owens kid, see what he can bring to a WrestleMania program, even though he's had two or three of them already, and he's been phenomenal. But, I think it's going to be Shane and Kevin Owens at WrestleMania, and I think it starts here.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if that is the case. This is where talking smack, still being around, would be incredibly useful.
Oh, and God, Owens was the man. That was his domain after
the
Miz
best
left. Oh,
geez. he was so fun. I was really excited when they did the Superstar Shuffle because it meant that Kevin Owens was going to be on Talking Smack every week. And the dynamic that was already forming between Kevin and Renee that had already been there and then Kevin and Daniel Bryan. Like, I mean, it was all very, very fun.
No one makes Renee Young more uncomfortable and gets in her business on that show like Kevin Owens did. And it was fantastic to that was always for me the magic of Talking Smack is when it would go off the rails a little bit and peek a little bit into what if this were quote unquote real type of thing. And that was always the magic of it being live is you kind of had that unpredictability that they say they have on the regular show.
Ooh, you know, there was one other thing from Bring It to the Table that I think is worth mentioning, which is the Enzo in the Doghouse segment.
Yeah, where he get kicked off the bus.
Yeah. So I think he is going to end up on 205 Live. I actually think that would be a good move for Enzo.
Do you think that? Because I'm thinking they're going to make that push for Gable eventually, possibly.
Dude, that show needs a charisma injection hard. I love Neville on 205 Live, and I am probably in the vast majority of, like, I watch 205 Live. I actually exactly like 205 Live. It's watchable. It's not necessarily memorable, but like it's easy, digestible wrestling that doesn't have a lot of the frills and stuff that I don't really care for. And I like Neville. And I really liked Austin Aries on that show. And ever since Aries has been gone, they've really needed someone who can cut a meaningful promo. You got Kendrick there. He's useful. Neville's useful. But man, Enzo and his intense baby-facedness would actually be a good foil for like the Brian Kendrick and a good foil for Neville.
I agree. If you're going to do the sports entertainment type of thing with the 205 Live brand, which they never should have done, they should have just kept the magic of the sports build of the CWC. This is the way to do it. And there's always one can't-miss match on 205 that's pretty darn good. I mean, Grand Metalik finally getting on TV this week.
That was a good match. That Grand Metalik and Tony Nese match was really good.
And I like Tony Nese a lot. I thought he was...
Me too.
I thought there'd be a lot... I thought Vince would take a real liking to him as a body guy and possibly not stick him in 205 and give him an upgrade. But you know what? I'm fine with him here. I always like him, and I like him and his Drew Gulak partnership. The Drew Gulak to me,
I like the Drew Gulak character as well.
I say this week after week. That's a guy who I could not bear to watch on the indies at all. He bored me to death.
Me too.
And this one, magic. He's absolutely magic on this show.
He's so funny. He's such a good promo. And I didn't see that coming because same reaction when I saw him in the indies and I just never really connected with the guy. I acknowledge that he was a good wrestler or whatever, but Catchpoint was like, okay, all right, that's fine.
Yeah, Catchpoint and him and Tracy, I mean, I'm not the biggest Tracy Williams guy on the stick either. I think he's a really good wrestler, but I mean, just that whole stable, it was kind of like with Drew and Tracy running it, just kind of, you know, Matt Riddle was the breakout star of that thing.
Right. Yeah. I'm definitely with you on that.
No. And so for the title match from SmackDown, a little bit of a surprise here, I thought. Shinsuke Nakamura beating John Cena to go on to face Jinder Mahal at SummerSlam. Now, here was my statement last week concerning this match, because I thought there was no way, absolutely no chance that Shinsuke Nakamura would win this match. Because I said, could you imagine the collective outcry of the internet fandom of Shinsuke Nakamura, work rate god when he's motivated, to a lot of these fans, going up against basically the WWE smoke and mirrors champ of Jinder Mahal, and not only having to have a good match, but also losing to him, probably clean.
I mean, I don't want to really think about Jinder Mahal beating Shinsuke Nakamura clean, and I imagine if he loses at SummerSlam, it's going to be with a lot of the Singh brothers in the mix here. To the actual match, though, between Cena and Nakamura, I think it was interesting in the context of the Bring It to the Table conversation about Cena and his drawing ability and star-making ability, because Cena does actually seem fairly committed to this project of making these guys that he's working with now on his wind down of his career.
Oh, the wind down. He's doing the Jericho thing.
Yes.
Where he wants to have the best match with the guy who's called the best, no matter what federation they're in. Like, he really wants a Kenny Omega match right now. I can tell you that right now. I can tell you that because he's hinted at it from time to time on his Instagram, which is nothing but him trolling people with certain hints about certain things. He never says outright what he wants. But you know, just because he likes his reputation now as Big Match John to do that. I enjoyed the second half of this match quite a lot. This is obviously the best Shinsuke match since the main roster, possibly even including his NXT run. But that last suplex spot, my God, that thing, when he dropped Cena on his head.
Right. And Cena's back has like no give either, because he's so defined in his upper body. So like when his head folds and the back basically doesn't give it all. Yeah. It was pretty rough looking.
And he tucked his chin on that, which was a mistake to do when you didn't over-rotate enough there. So, I mean, there was a lot going on in that. I'm hoping that doesn't affect
change
Nakamura.
Shinsuke's style.
I mean, you can tell that he apologized after the match.
He visibly says, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, it was a great match and afterwards not seen by those of us who watched just that. This happened on the network. Baron Corbin coming down, attacking Shinsuke Nakamura, and I think he puts Cena through a table. So I'm thinking that the SummerSlam match is going to be John Cena versus Baron Corbin. And wait for this, because this is a WWE move. Corbin loses early in the night to John Cena.
And then he cashes in
and beats Nakamura for the title after the Jinder Mahal match.
That's kind of where I think this is going, because Nakamura has all those wins stacked up on Baron Corbin now, too. So it would make all the sense that Nakamura wins the title, Corbin goes for the cash in, or maybe even inserts himself into the match Rollins style.
Yeah. I don't think that happens. I don't think it becomes a three-way unless... See, the only way it becomes a three-way is if they're okay with beating Jinder, like clean, to screw Nakamura out of it, I think.
Yeah, I don't know. That's an interesting point, too, because you still would have
Jinder. I think Jinder and the Singh brothers beat the crap out of Nakamura during this match, but Nakamura wins the title and they beat the shit out of him.
Yeah. Corbin comes out.
But even during the match, they're interfering and stuff and wearing him down. Yes, they do the beatdown after the match. Corbin's music hits. He comes down. He cashes in. Singh's a little bit mad because they had been playing up a little bit of animosity between them on Talking Smack and SmackDown after he won the briefcase. So they can kind of continue those hints, even though I never think they'll pay that off. And then he wins the title and gets a relatively short run here in the post-SummerSlam, pre-beginning of the year time to see what he can do, too. So, I mean, it would make total sense to have both. God, we may have both Braun Strowman and Baron Corbin as champs on their respective brands.
Well, that will be an interesting test of the homegrown talent.
Yeah. It's tall guys. My guys. And man, you know who that would feed? That would feed the guys who have the political hit on Triple H theories all over the internet, who think Vince constantly is trying to downgrade the effect of NXT. And no, the guys I like are
these beefcake dudes. I mean, like, there's something to that. You know, all of the like work rate monsters like Nakamura, AJ Styles, Kevin Owens are relegated to the middle of the card or flirting with the top title. And the people who you have the top titles on are guys that Vince would be on board with, whether it's Brock, who we all love, but Brock's a Vince guy and for obvious reasons has the belt. But then Jinder Mahal is clearly a Vince-style experiment. Braun Strowman would be a Vince-style experiment. Roman Reigns, whatever they're going to do with him. Certainly if they tried to do it with him as a face. But even like turning him heel at this point, that's going to be a Vince-style experiment. Oh, by the way, on Roman Reigns, I think what's going to happen is Roman's going to turn heel on Seth and Dean. So the fake out is that Dean and Seth are going to screw each other over. They're not. Roman's going to screw them over.
I don't think Roman screws him over. I think he just walks away because he's one against all. And they've been playing up this rugged individualist thing. I don't think it's a heel turn per se, but I could see them turning Seth and Dean heel against Roman for not joining him. I could see that happen.
Well, they were flirting the proxies for Vince, Corey and JBL on Bring It to the Table were flirting with this notion of the Roman Reigns heel turn. So I think that one's coming, let's say, a lot sooner than the John Cena heel turn is.
You've just made Wade Keller very happy. He's been pushing that for the better part of a year and a half. Well, you know what Roman needs here is a heel turn.
He needs to be a heel, but I'll give you a hot take. Bray Wyatt needs to be a face, and the continued insistence on making him a heel is just as asinine as Roman Reigns being a face.
I would agree. That's a babyface entrance. You got to make him a babyface. And they actually did turn them kind of face in that Shield feud a little bit, and then they turned them right back heel the next week or something. There was a time they brought them back to jump some heels and get involved, and they eventually turned them heel the next week again to kind of kill that. I forget what it was, but
there was the flirtation against not the corporation, but like Triple H's faction, whatever the hell it was called at that time. And the Wyatts were kind of against the corporation.
They were playing tweeners, 3.0. And they got a huge pop. And then the next week, heel move. So it's like, that interest lasted 1 week exactly. Speaking of NXT, really great main event this week, I thought. And in the past 2 weeks, Aleister Black has now beaten both members of the former ROH and PWG tag team champions, Bobby Fish. And this week, Kyle O'Reilly makes his debut for NXT. What did you think of that?
Oh, man, what a great match this was. And I was just thinking about this as I was watching that main event, that it's 2017. And this week on SmackDown, I watched Nakamura and Cena. And on NXT, you get Kyle O'Reilly versus Aleister Black with Mauro Ranallo and Nigel McGuinness calling it. It's all very surreal. Like,
it
it's
is.
Weird what NXT has become.
It's become kind of a little fantasy league of indie wrestling in its own way. It's very, I mean, if I could get rid of Percy Watson, I'd be very, very happy.
You and me both, brother. But like the striking and the fact that they were working a very not WWE style match,
yes,
I think played to this perfectly. I love the more MMA combat sports inspired wrestling that has been coming up, and WWE has been very, very slow to incorporate this stuff and will only incorporate it in like little fits and starts. You'll get like CM Punk or Daniel Bryan who will try to push that envelope, but by and large, they don't like doing that. I love that O'Reilly and Aleister Black were able to just go at it.
I just like having differences of styles. Like, I think a tag team match, a really great tag team match, has its own fluidity to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I like having a brawl here and there. I like having a nice technical match. You know, I like having like one aerial choreography type of high spot type thing. And then I like having this type of thing, which is kind of like a mixture of them all. I do think that they team up Fish and O'Reilly or keep them separate, because that tag team division losing a little bit of depth here with injuries and call-ups and the like.
Yeah, I think that putting together Red Dragon would be good. I think the Authors of Pain need some competition, too, that doesn't suck, because I am not interested remotely in the Sanity versus Authors of Pain angle. Like, no. It just doesn't. And oh my god, that Ellering promo this week, that was a terrible promo. And that was a pre-tape. That was a very bad promo.
No, I agree. The whole Book of Pain thing, it's
another chapter in the Book of Pain.
Well, Sanity ripped out the pages of their imaginary book. That's how we'll build this feud, as opposed to just... See, I always liked, and I'll date myself here, did you ever watch or ever see any episodes of the late 80s show Roller Games?
No.
It was roller derby, you know, booked like professional wrestling. It was better than Roller Jam on TNN, I'll tell you that much right now.
Roller Jam kind of sucked.
A little bit more schlocky, because like they had a gator pit that they had to jump over. You know, it was very, very WWE meets roller derby. But the cool thing they did was they'd have these heel-on-heel matches and babyface-on-babyface matches. And they had the bad guys who were called Bad Attitude, and they had this one group of heels who were just mercenaries called the Maniacs. But they were just kind of in it for money, and they're also a little bit crazy as well. So you had kind of, I always loved that dynamic of bad versus evil. And this is what that Sanity versus Authors of Pain thing should have. I mean, I never minded heel versus heel matches. Like when they were first doing the build for like the Midnight Express versus Tully and Arn.
Oh, that was great.
And they eventually
that was
had,
awesome.
And they eventually babied the Midnight Express in the feud. But it was still such, like, yes, bad guys are not supposed to get along with other bad guys, and there are varying levels in terms of what people want and what their motivations are to make people evil. And that feud played on it perfectly. That's what I wanted out of this feud. But instead we're getting, you know, sports entertainment. Oh, they took the book and they ripped out pages and they threw it up in the air like a third grade classroom or something. And Paul Ellering is just, he's not interesting is my problem.
Yeah.
In any of these
I feel like in spurts, he's fine. But extended exposure exposes him. Yeah. There's another talking point out of NXT I wanted to hit, which is the English as a second language promos, particularly with a guy I love, but I have to, you know, lay it in on him. Hideo Itami. He was injured for basically the better part of 2 years here. And his English is still really rough, and his ability to deliver a promo is really bad. And like, I don't know how someone didn't sit him down with a Rosetta Stone and go, look, man, if you're going to make it here in WWE in this product, you're going to have more competency with English.
Yeah, it's the stubbornness of not hiring a guy to talk for him versus, well,
that's
let's
also
see,
true.
Let's see how motivated he is to be a star in this company. Let's see if he can learn a completely new language in a few months. You know, it's.
But it's not a few months, and that's my point. I think it's a completely unfair criticism in the first 2 months or 3 months or even 6 months. Like, that is one thing. When he was injured and not in the ring and didn't have to focus on any of that, that is when I expected him to come back from that injury with a better grasp on English.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I always thought his promo should be, or his gimmick should be. If you ever saw that episode of the Simpsons where the Yakuza gets involved in the mob war,
I already know where you're going. Yes, he's
the guy in the white suit.
The silent
guy in the white suit who's going to do something really cool as soon as you turn away. That's who I wanted Hideo Itami to be this entire time. Okay, good. At least I didn't go too deep for that cut right there.
Oh, no, I'm completely with you. My co-host over on Lucha the Hidden Temple, you know, hosts a Simpsons podcast, so I'm up on some of these things. but like, I like what they did, you know, to continue on that conversation. I like pairing Andrade Cien Almas with Selena, because
yes,
I think that gives his character something to play off of. She can be the mouthpiece for him. I think that actually works really well. They probably should have paired Hideo with somebody, but really, if he just delivered one-liners and they were all really badass and cool every time, you could work around that too.
Yeah, no, I agree. Yeah, he should be the strong silent type and play. You know, he's a guy that should have the evil foreigner gimmick of anybody on this roster. I think Selena, I mean, that is a gimmick restoration right there.
Oh, yeah.
Cien Almas was dying, and this is really the first time that the you're not being motivated, kind of that breaking the fourth wall type of gimmick, has really come off well in a long, long time on WWE television.
This works great, because the whole you're not being motivated thing feeds into why this character, Cien Almas, would allow himself to hitch his wagon to Selena, who's certainly going to be revealed over time to be more and more crazy.
Yeah, it's one of those reasons I love NXT so much. The only other thing I wanted to bring up on NXT is this rumor from The Observer that there's a possibility that people from the main roster who have some NXT nostalgia to attach to them, or perhaps people that they want to rehab, may get brought back down to NXT.
The show's not long enough to accommodate that, is my thought on that. I think that it's an hour program. It's a tight program. If it was 90 minutes, there's probably room to do something like that. But I worry that resetting characters from the main roster down in NXT is going to be counterproductive to developing the people you've already got going down there.
Here's my fear, is that they don't see enough in Sami Zayn as a main roster act that they're going to put him back down on NXT.
Oh, I know. I really worry about that. But he's so not over on the main roster, right? I mean, I like him, but he flounders, and I don't think it's his fault.
No, it's not. I mean,
it's not his fault, but
you're losing to Mike
floundering.
Losing to Mike Kanellis and then Aiden English this week, it's just like, oh, man. It's like they're taking all that goodwill and well, let's take a flyer on this guy who has the same annoying gimmick as the annoying singing guy on Raw. And I'm just
he's not even an underdog anymore. The way he lost to Aiden English wasn't underdoggy at all.
No,
like,
it was
an underdog
dumb.
Would fight his ass out to get out of a roll up like that.
Yeah, it's what they were doing with Becky Lynch for a number of weeks, where it's like, you're the smartest competitor on this roster. You're the best wrestler on the women's division. Oh, a theme song. Well, what's over there, huh? And then gets rolled up for a pin. And you're just like, this doesn't give her any credibility. It just makes her look like a moron.
I like that they actually have incorporated Becky is dumb when it comes to Friends as like a character part now.
It's the Bayley and NXT thing story.
Yeah, I don't know, but she even brings it up. She's like, well, I'm kind of an idiot when it comes to picking my friends. It's like, that's an admirable quality.
She's Sting. She gets it. She's Sting. Yeah. Everybody turns on me. You were nice enough this week to join us in our little gimmick here. We watch Glow every week.
Okay.
We've started doing that. And this week we got up to episode 5. I don't know if you've watched up to episode 5 or if you've just watched this episode.
Jeff, I am your friend, so I watched this episode because you asked me to, but I have not watched up to it yet.
Okay, well, that'll make it even more interesting. I'm a little down on this episode because if I had a subtitle for it, I would call it "This One's for the Ladies."
That was definitely how I felt. There was a lot of very female-oriented storylines in this one, like the crush with the pizza boy.
Yeah, that. Thank you. That. So let me get this straight. It's teenage angst, teenage love type of story with a presumably someone
a punk rocker
in their 20s. Yes, a goth emo type anachronism in the 80s. And the first thing she's going to do is hook up with the dude. I didn't buy it. I'm sorry. I just did not buy it from that way. The credibility was not established. I mean, I could see that being a fantasy sequence and then going on to like an awkward type style date and then eventually falling into that. But just, hey, I bought a pizza for you. Here's a guy to bone you. See you later. I just went, no, I'm sorry. I can't. Maybe I'm just too old fashioned. What were your thoughts on that?
No, I'm with you. I thought it sort of undermined the whole story of them being awkward. The idea would be like, they have a hard time communicating, so the actual hookup scene would be something that you'd pay off later on in the season rather than to just sort of tease this with both of them going like, hey, hey,
yeah.
Hey, want to hook up? Okay. It's just a little flat for me, it was silly. The whole thing, I get the puppy love element and playing with that, but this pushed the bounds of reason, and by the third time the pizza guy was there, I was like, enough with the pizza guy!
Yeah, I find that actress endearing in the character.
Oh, yeah.
I think she's great doing
that.
She's
my speed. I like it. But yeah, no, I feel you.
And the other moment that I'll get to the good parts of this episode in a moment, but the other part that I just went, no, that's a little too on the nose, was when they actually went to the American Legion Hall. It's a little bit gussied up for this show, but that's the Legion Hall where PWG runs its shows.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the actual dump that we sit in, and that's the actual sweat box we sit in for Bola, kids. That's although it looks much better because it had a lot of like really fancy lighting and stuff in there that we don't get. The aha moment of the soap opera actress realizing wrestling's a soap opera.
Oh, I know, right?
She's been such a smart, well-written character up to this point. I understand looking down on wrestling as a character trait, but to be that obtuse and then have the aha moment right before an Alex Riley match or Steel Horse, I just that was just a little bit. It was too on the nose for me.
No, I'm with you. It's kind of weird for her to be earlier in the episode talking about how she's this caricature Liberty Bell, the all-American girl, and everything like that. And then just finally grasping, oh my God, this is like a soap opera or a comic book. Yeah, especially your brand of wrestling. Yeah.
Yeah.
You guys say that your wrestling is stereotypes. Like, yeah, of course. Yes. Like soap operas, they have stereotypes. Like comic books, they have stereotypes. Your wrestling is caricatures.
Yeah, I did like playing her mother was a stand-up comic from, she was signed to a sitcom deals back in the mid-90s, back when they were trying to find the next Roseanne, woman by the name of Lisa Ann Walter, who does some radio out here occasionally, but she was an absolute sweetheart when I was still on the stand-up circuit, so this was when they were signing, like, Brett Butlers of the world. And
right,
Roseanne,
right.
Yeah, they were trying to find the next kind of blue-collar woman who's
from
also,
middle America.
Who's also brainy. You know, type of thing. That was the whole archetype. So, I mean, that popped me a bit. This is also possibly the most endearing I've found Allison Brie on this show, because she plays the overeager actress character and everything like that. But she still kind of becomes naturally unlikable and or at least I mean, she's cringe humor. She's Tina Fey. She's playing Tina Fey, a Tina Fey role.
Which one's Alison Brie?
She was the one who
the Russian. Okay.
Yeah, she played the Russian. She broke out of the Russian accent.
Yeah. No, I liked her as the Russian. Yeah, no, I thought that, and I liked her falling into the character and really sort of gravitating into the character. I liked that whole sequence at the patio furniture store.
Yeah, and that's been her role on this show, is that she's the thespian of the group who views this as acting, and I'm in an acting role. She's the archetype of every struggling actor in Los Angeles who's being, you know, very try hard about what's my character's motivation and things like that. Since she slept with her best friend's husband, she's been kind of the butt of all the jokes as well, in that she's the heel, but they don't have a character for her, so they've just been kind of playing up the reality of what a bitch she was to turn on her best friend. And what she really wants is a character to sink my teeth into, and she got her opportunity here during the patio furniture bit. No, I really liked that part of it, but overall the episode...
And Chris Daniels. Chris Daniels, best moonsault ever.
A moonsault in the early 80s, huh? Okay.
I know. No, not just a moonsault, a fancy pants moonsalt, the best moonsault ever.
Yes.
Yeah, and, not like the Lanny Poffo moonsault that I kind of like the way Poffo does his, but not even like that. Like, yeah.
And Joey Ryan.
Joey Ryan. Yes, I like it. Joey Ryan with his ring valets.
Yeah, and this is I actually liked Alex Riley in this. I did.
He was fine in this.
Yeah, I didn't care for him when they got off of commentary and tried to be a wrestler again in NXT, but I thought he was quite all right on this. I mean, you know, he has some acting chops, but I mean, he was fine kind of playing. Yeah, he played. He didn't have much to stretch on, but at least he was likable, and I get points for likability when it's a natural.
I think he did. He did a good job delivering the kind of wrestling content too. The part where he is explaining how heels and faces play off of each other. Yeah. It was good to have a wrestler explaining that, because that dialogue felt very natural.
Yeah, you don't. Having a wrestler explain was probably better than having, say, Mark Maron explain. And I like Mark Maron's snark. I you know, it becomes overbearing at times, but it's never unwelcome, I think is the way, yes, I'd put it. Because there are no changes in his demeanor, absolutely. No matter how much character development they give him, he's always going to be this jerk who does not want to be here in some ways, and I always find that somewhat...
I love that this is purely utilitarian for him.
Mark Maron is playing Mark Maron in a costume that you're not supposed to think he's Mark Maron, but he's Mark Maron. I enjoy that. He's an anachronism in his own show.
So what I will say is that, like, this show, I enjoyed it enough by the time I got to the end of the episode where I was like, I'd watch some more episodes of GLOW. I don't know that I'll watch all of it. And honestly, I don't know that I have time to watch all of it. I people are always making me television recommendations, and I'm like, yes, someday, maybe, yeah, I will get to that.
I don't like it enough where I'd be binge watching this, but if I have time, I'd do it. And if it wasn't for the show I want, for me, it's become kind of a roller coaster where it's like, great episode, episode. Like the episode before this, fantastic. I love it. It's like the even number episodes are great. The odd number episodes that set up the action for the odd number episodes, you know, not my thing. But
so let me ask you then a question about my love life. Should I save this for like the next time I'm dating someone, and, you know, like we want to sit down as a couple and watch like a series, and this could be a thing that's like wrestling-y that
I'll
I can watch
something
with a lady?
Rob's now wife was a fiance at the time we recorded it, came on the show. She adored this show.
Okay.
And
okay.
And the female comics in my circle, they usually give all these female projects a lot of leeway anyways. I'll put it that way.
They really
like it. I've seen people not involved in comedy that are my friends, like people I went to college with on social media, say they loved it. So yes, the women will like it. And if you ever decide to divulge you're a wrestling fan to a member of the opposite sex, not something I recommend necessarily.
I professionally don't have much of a choice.
No, that's true.
It comes up sooner rather than later in my life.
That's true. But I try not to. I mean, but yes, this is a way for you to. Well, this is kind of what interests me about it. This is kind of how it all works. It's not just brainless fun or whatever, but yeah, no, it's a way you can watch it together and you can get a little bit out of it and she can get a little bit out of it and you'll be both very happy. But taking dating advice from ask the Tinder boss Lanza, because I've had Tinder for years and I think I've never gotten a match.
Well, you gotta get off Tinder and get on Bumble, dude. Like Tinder's dead now. It's all about Bumble.
I've done Tinder. I've done eHarmony. I've done OK Stupid. I've done all of
those. OK Stupid's awful. The OK Stupid is the shitty dive bar that you go into, and there are 15 people there, and you look around, and they're all kind of unappealing. There's one that you're kind of interested in. You send them a message, and they're not interested. And then you come back to the bar the next night, and you're like, oh, maybe something will be different. But nothing's different. It's the same 15 people who were there last night and the week before.
I've done plenty of fish, or at least I've signed up for it. I've never, because all the emails I got out of there, all the emails I got were women from out of town who, it's a Christian dating site. So it's like, first you get the sob story and then it's like, but I found Jesus. And I'm like, it's the sob story that's bugging me.
Yeah. It's funny. Usually you can't just turn the page that easy in life I've discovered. Yes, yeah. It's not that easy.
So, Chris, tell the people where they can find you. Put in your plugs. Get your shit in, so to speak.
Well, Rob, Jeff, thank you guys so much for having me on. If you want to hear more from me on the wrestling side, I host a show called Lucha the Hidden Temple. You can find that right at voicesofwrestling.com or on this iTunes and or Stitcher stream. I also host a show about news and politics that is called Don't Worry About the Government. Our homepage is don'tworry.tv. We're also on iTunes and Stitcher. If you want to follow me on Twitter, I talk some about wrestling when I'm watching wrestling, but I talk about politics when I'm watching politics. So just caveat right there. But my Twitter account is at CHRISNOVEMBRINO. Jeff, always a pleasure.
Oh, no, thank you very much. You can follow me at CrapGame13. You can follow the show and Rob McCarron at ShakeThemRopes, all one word. And since Rob wasn't here this week for feeling under the weather and being a little bit exhausted between work and the wedding, please feel free to tweet him about the wedding and give your congratulations to him. I hope nothing for the best for him, and I hope his wife is very patient with us as we continue this podcasting endeavor. Chris, one more question. Have you ever seen a ghost?